Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted and honored to have on the show today the renowned American moral philosopher Martha Nussbaum. She is the Ernst Freund Distinguished Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, where she holds appointments in the Department of Philosophy and the Law School. She is the recipient of a prodigious number of scholarly and public honors and awards, including this summer the prestigious Kyoto Prize. She has written prolifically in an array of fields, including Greek and Roman philosophy, political philosophy, moral philosophy, psychology, education, women's rights, gender issues, and animal rights. Her focus spans the range of human experience from the cultivation of the individual soul to the evolution of global justice. As one of our most sought-after public intellectuals, she is a scholar who has, over the course of her career, generously been willing to step out of the ivory tower in order to engage wider audiences on philosophical questions toward advancing the progress of justice as a public good. With all her research and writing, her teaching, and her public appearances, I'm delighted she's taking the time to talk with us by telephone about her latest book, Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice, published this April by Oxford University Press. Hello, Martha.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Excellent, thank you. It's great to have you on the show. So to start, the human emotions are a consistent theme in much of your writing and moral philosophy. So the question is, why did you want to give, in this book, anger special treatment?
Well, I guess you could divide my writing on emotions into three phases. The first phase was when I was just primarily interpreting texts from ancient Greek and Roman philosophy in The Fragility of Goodness and Therapy of Desire. And, of course, their thinking about emotions is enormously rich, and I got drawn into that, but didn't really express views of my own. Then the second phase is represented by the book Upheavals of Thought, where I really did develop a theory of my own of what emotions are, drawing on anthropology and psychology, still, of course, drawing on the Greeks and Romans, but really trying to have an adequate contemporary theory. And in that book, I did focus particularly on grief, compassion, and love. So then we have phase three, where I then did a number of very concrete investigations of more specific emotions, particularly then as I was turning more toward political philosophy, linking them with the political issues. So there was the book on disgust and shame and their role in political thought. There's a book on fear and its role in religious intolerance and religious panic about new immigrants and so on. And then, of course, I needed to say something about anger, because it was just one that I hadn't really said much about, and I now think that the few scattered remarks that I did make about it were, in some cases, not correct. So I had an occasion to give the John Locke lectures in Oxford, and I was looking around for a good topic. I had just written an op-ed about retributive anger in an Indian newspaper, and it just seemed to me this is a great topic, and it's high time for me to do that and to take on also the culture of forgiveness and apology that's so prominent today. So it was the occasion of the lectures that stimulated me, but then when I actually got to thinking about it, as I say, I realized that I had not understood anger correctly and that I really wanted to say something quite different from what I had said before. So that was exciting, and I love changing my mind and I love doing something new.
It's obvious you've done a lot of very wide-ranging research for this book.
Well, I think the area of emotions has grown the way it has because it's very interdisciplinary. I already, in Upheavals of Thought, I had a whole chapter on neuroscience, a whole chapter on cognitive psychology, and I think particularly neglected are anthropological studies and historical studies of emotion, and I had already learned a lot from the great anthropologist Jean Briggs and her book, wonderful book called Never in Anger, about an Inuit tribe that she studied up in Canada, who believe, like the Stoics, that anger is always childish and destructive. And so, you know, I had already studied that book, and I teach it regularly, but then integrating all those different perspectives is what I really like to do.
Oftentimes, the most interesting people I talk to will have an interdisciplinary bent.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to be interdisciplinary because you have to exercise your own judgment, and I think that inevitably the way I kind of do it is I get certain people that I trust, and people, particularly in cognitive psychology, I guess I have certain heroes, Paul Rosen, who works on disgust, Dan Batson, who works on compassion, and there's a whole bunch of people who work on anger, and of course I'm interested in psychoanalytic thought too, but yes, so I try to be as responsible as I can while still not deferring completely to everything that gets said, because I think sometimes psychologists don't define their terms carefully. So, you know, the ones that are my heroes, they're the ones who do.
I don't know if there are ways to measure anger in a given society, but I wonder myself if the United States isn't, at least at the moment, a particularly angry society. I know it's an election cycle. That has something to do with
well,
anything,
I think there are two separate questions. Yeah. One is how much anger actually occurs inside people. Well, there are really three questions. Second, how much do people express it and in what ways? But the question that interests me is, what are the social norms? Because, of course, you could have a society, and I think ancient Greece and Rome were like this, where there's a huge amount of anger and people are very ungoverned with respect to their anger, and they're always kind of hauling off against each other. By the way, the American founding was like that, too. I'm just reading a marvelous book about the emotions of the founders by Joanne Freeman called Affairs of Honor, where she talks about the culture of retribution and honor and dueling and so on. So anyway, lots of cultures have had a lot of anger, but the question is, how do you think about it? Is it what a proper person has, or is it something that's regarded as unfortunate, infantile, and so on? Now, I think in America, we've always had a very high evaluation of anger in connection with a norm of manliness. And there is psychological research that shows that even little babies, when the experimental subject doesn't know what gender the baby is and the baby is crying, if they think it's a boy, if they're told he and so on, then they'll say, oh, he really is angry. He wants to get what he wants. And if they think it's a little girl, if the experimenter says she, then they say, oh, poor thing, she's very frightened, and so on. So we think it's connected to manliness. Now, of course, that's very complicated. Even in the Wild West, as represented in movies, we don't have a rosy picture of anger. High Noon is a wonderful example here, because he's got to not be a pacifist like his wife, but he has to also be very cool and very collected. And so he's not the angry man, actually, Gary Cooper isn't. So anyway, it's a mixed record, but I would say on the whole, we think that the real man is one who gets angry. Do you remember, you probably don't, I don't know how old you are because I've never seen you, but the presidential campaign where Michael Dukakis lost?
Oh, yes,
well,
yeah.
The key moment was when he was asked about this. He had had this prison work release program, and a convict in that program had raped a woman, Willie Horton, and when he was asked on TV, what would you say if Willie Horton raped your wife? Dukakis was very cool, and he said, well, you know, I'd have to think, is that the reason to invalidate the whole policy? So he was too collected, too rational, and they thought that he wasn't a real man, and of course he was short anyway, so they were already thinking he's not a real man. So I think that's the thing that America has, which not every culture has.
Interesting in this light is Hillary Clinton's recent account of having to learn to control her emotions while being basically heckled by some of the men in the room when she was preparing to take her law school entrance exams as an explanation for her own coolness.
Well, she's amazing. I watched, because I was out of town during the Benghazi hearing, so I happened to be in a hotel room with nothing else to do but to watch the Benghazi hearing. I have never seen such a consummate performance of non-anger. I don't know what she felt inside, but I have to say, she must have, at some level, exercised meditative self-control, because I don't think you can feel a lot of anger and not express it over the course of so many hours.
Gary Cooper would have been proud, actually, of that performance.
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
so, you know.
Yeah. Yes. And, of course, Obama is like that, too, because a black man who gets angry could not be elected, and he's exercised great self-control. Yeah. But that's a different story, because I think it's made him seem aloof, and I think it's a reason why Americans don't warm up to him. Mm-hmm. But that's another story.
Yeah. In this vein, one of the historical insights that you offered that kind of jumped out at me in the book had to do with the status of anger in the ancient world, where we, as you say, seem to regard rage as an attribute of manly virtue. That wasn't the case in ancient Greece and Rome, was it?
No. I want to recommend to all readers a wonderful book by William Harris, an ancient historian who teaches at Columbia, called Restraining Rage. And it's a comprehensive study of everything that's said about anger in the Greek and Roman world. And what Harris really nails is that although, of course, people got angry, nonetheless, it was typically thought to be either infantile or womanish. So they might not think you should remove it entirely. There was difference of opinion about that. But they really thought it was a flaw in an adult man if he got angry a lot. And so you see letters of Cicero to his brother saying, well, heard good things about you in the provinces, but there's one criticism that I hear, which is that you get angry a lot, and that's really very childish, so stop it. So, yeah, that's different from what we think an American would hear.
So you mentioned you like people who define their terms, and you spend some time actually defining anger. So could you tell us what anger is?
Yeah, I mean, here I really think the best place to start is Aristotle's definition of anger, which, by the way, pretty much every philosopher in the Western tradition has accepted, with one important modification that I'll get to. Basically, he wants to say anger is a painful emotion that responds to a significant damage that's done to something that you believe to be important, whether it's you or some friend or whatever, and a damage that you believe to have been wrongfully inflicted. And then he says, but the anger itself is painful, but part of being angry is also to have a kind of pleasant wish for payback. Now, that's the part I zero in on, because I do believe that Aristotle's correct, that that's a conceptual part of what anger is. Mm-hmm. You see that it has unanimous philosophical support through the ages and also support from empirical psychologists. That if you have something that has all the other stuff but lacks the payback wish, well, it's something else. It's sort of compassionate grief or some other painful emotion, but the wish for payback. And I'm sure this is part of why anger evolved. It's a kind of strike-back response. But it's that I think is the problem. Because, of course, people believe that if you pay back pain for pain, that somehow rights the balance in nature, it makes everything balanced out or better. But, of course, that's just magical thinking. It isn't true. Killing someone else's child does not bring back your own child. Raping a rapist doesn't atone for the terrible trauma and pain of the rape. So, although there would be plenty of reasons to punish a criminal offender, those reasons have to be considered in a forward-looking perspective. Just thinking, let's punish him because he did X in the past, is not enough, because punishment inflicting pain does not atone for or balance out the pain in the past. It might be good to incapacitate a criminal. It might be good to deter that criminal from committing future crimes. It might be good to deter other criminals from committing future crimes. And, of course, there might even be an issue of reform. But all of those rational issues are not issues of payback. So it's the idea of payback that I really want to strike out at. However, here back to Aristotle, the one thing that he said that people don't agree with, and I don't agree with either, is that anger is always a response not to just any old kind of damage, but to a very particular sort, what he calls a downranking.
Yes.
In other words, a status injury. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's lots of that, and it's very common in all societies, but, of course, we can wish for payback in other connections, and we can get angry at other things, so it's too narrow. However, It's narrow in a way that's quite interesting, because it's one case, and I think it's the only case, where the idea of payback really makes sense. Because if you imagine society as a kind of zero-sum hierarchy, then if you push your offender relatively lower in the social hierarchy, you automatically do push yourself relatively higher. Yeah. And since we're imagining that relative status is all you're caring about, we don't have to worry about anything else. So that does make sense. However, it's a very narrow way of looking at the world. And I think we shouldn't look at the world that way.
No. It is useful, however, in that it does explain the emotion of anger. It does for me in some cases. When I read that passage in your book, and I roamed around the next few days noticing the occasions that made me angry, I have to say it was usually some slight to status. And usually the emotion was much more than the occasion really warranted when I thought about it. Maybe that comes from a sort of sense of vulnerability. It probably does, but you know.
You know, it probably does. Yeah. But I do think it's very common. The empirical psychologists are surprised by how common it is. I think it's common in close personal relationships, but even more common in the part of life that I call the middle realm, that is where you're negotiating with rude airline personnel and incompetent techs. I won't mention particular companies, I guess, that are most incompetent. Yeah. But, you know, that kind of thing, which drives me crazy, is really very commonly it's about status, because I deserve to be treated well, is what people are really saying.
But it is narcissistic, and there's no notion of real wrongfulness here, is there?
There can be that, too. That is to say, I do think that personnel should be competent, and I think they should also behave with civility. Those are good things to demand. But the status things gets mixed in with that in a way that's not helpful. And, of course, that happens in academic life, too. We all know people who are scanning the internet for every reference to themselves and their work all the time. And what they really want to see is who has said something negative about me. And then they think if they go out and they insult that person and attack that person's work, then the balance is righted. Well, of course, that's stupid, because it doesn't remove any real faults that your work had or make it better than it was before. And if the criticism is not correct, then it's probably just best to ignore it.
So anyone familiar with your work at all knows that you often employ close readings of literary texts to illustrate your arguments. And in Poetic Justice and also in Cultivating Humanity, you wrote about just this, the importance of literature for explicating, at least if not shaping, moral and political thought. And in Anger and Forgiveness here, you engage in many readings, actually, of certain classic texts. And you start the book with a commentary on the significance of the Furies in Aeschylus's Orestia as they're transformed into the benevolent Eumenides. And traditionally, this is read to suggest that the law has at its core a primitive impulse to retribution, and there's a dark side to the law, essentially. But you revised this reading, and in some ways that reading serves for me anyway as a kind of emblem for much of what you have to say over the course of the whole book on anger and justice. So I wonder if you can talk about that.
Well, of course, here I'm not using literature in any very deep or philosophical way. It's simply an example to get us started, and I think it's a very vivid example. I actually think you're giving me too much credit for originality, because although there was one very influential British classicist, Sir Hugh Lloyd-Jones, who made much of the more retributive reading, and so in that way it had wide influence, I don't think what I'm saying is very new or unusual. I mean, it's just sort of obvious if you look at the text, namely that the Furies don't retain a retributive nature. They change, and they have to change in order to join Athena's project. Mm-hmm. They have to be forward-looking, they have to be benevolent, they have to have rational persuasion, and they have to, you know, embody the new attitudes that the city requires. And by the way, Harris has this superb chapter on the play in his book, and it's very much what I say, but it's at greater length, and just showing that that's what the Greeks and Romans actually thought. They did not like retribution. None of the major Greek and Roman philosophers is a retributivist about the criminal law. They all think it should be a question of forward-looking, welfare-based deterrence.
So if we regard anger as a kind of toxic substance, both for our individual persons and for our institutions, how do we respond to and prevent those very real injuries and crimes that do make us angry? I mean, what do we deploy instead of anger?
Yeah. Well, of course, the people I get to in the last full chapter of the book thought a lot about this question. That is Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Nelson Mandela. And they all insist that you can protest against great injustice without anger. Now, what they mean is you must make your demand, you make it forcefully, you even make it at some risk of life and limb. We don't acquiesce, said Gandhi. But, so Gandhi actually said, when I say we should not resent, I don't mean we should acquiesce. You stand up for yourself, you make a vivid protest, but not with the spirit of payback. And of course, King was especially preoccupied with that because there was so much desire for racial payback in the society, and there were other black leaders who were calling for payback. So he was very emphatic that we have to make a good future, to build, as he says, a world where men and women can live together, we have to work together. So the challenge is to figure out what attitudes that requires. And so that is when he starts to talk about love. But he makes it very clear that he doesn't mean, you know, squishy, sentimental love. He doesn't mean you even have to like the people. You just have to wish them well and wish well to the whole common enterprise. And of course, that's very hard. Yeah. And so King had to train people. And I guess he felt that it would be best if they dropped their retributive anger altogether, but at the very least, they have to inhibit it when they go out into the marches. So he prepared them by what he called self-purification. And, of course, that was a long process. He didn't let them go on to the marches unless they'd had considerable training.
That was a political context. What about the legal context? Built into our laws are prescriptions for punishment to assuage individual and social anger. And these often seem to involve a kind of payback, actually very measured kind of payback in terms of numbers of years for a given crime with certain constraints. So it pretends to a kind of rationality, this payback. And I wonder about how you can build a transition into the law. And you use the term transition anger.
Okay, well, let me clarify that. Okay. So I say if we realize that payback is futile and we want to orient ourselves instead toward the future, which is the only thing we can change, then we turn, and that is what I call the transition with a capital T, we turn toward the future. Now, I then say that there's a special species of sort of borderline anger that's at that turning point already, and we could call it therefore transition anger, namely an emotion whose whole content is how outrageous this is, that had better not happen again. So in other words, it lacks the payback wish, it's headed to the future, and so it is that kind of unusual anger that doesn't wish for payback. And I say that I think we all recognize this as an emotion that parents have toward their very young children. They are outraged, but they don't want to pay back pain for pain. They want good for the child. So yeah, I mean, in society, our criminal justice system has many different rationales, and there's been a debate through the centuries. As I say, the Greeks and Romans thought the best rationale for criminal punishment was, in fact, welfarist and deterrence-based. That's a prominent view today, too, but the retributive view is very, very prominent, and I would say it's probably the dominant view in American criminal justice. So we have to figure out what to do about that. Now, the first thing we can do is, of course, criticize it. But see, this is where I don't really like this single-minded focus on punishment. Because if you think about the whole problem of crime in a society, once we've got the criminal act, it's really one step too late. The question is, why did that criminal act take place? And I believe, I think on plausible assumptions about human nature, namely that most people would rather be loved and nurtured and supported and educated, given jobs and so on, we would really not have a whole subclass of hardened criminals from birth. And so once we get the criminal and the criminal act, there's already a kind of social failure. Yeah. So I think the first thing we should do in approaching crime is to think ex ante rather than ex post. How do we bring up young people in our society to bring it about that they're not criminals? We should give them schooling, nutrition, health care, love, and so on and so on. And now, of course, despite our best efforts, and that project is enormously complex, we don't really know how to do it. Mm-hmm. So we probably will continue failing with some people for some time. Then we do still get criminal acts, and then we should turn to thinking about punishment. Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing to say is, although legal philosophers who are probably not a very vicious lot, they're rather gentle people, but they like tough talk, and they do talk a lot about hard treatment. Mm-hmm. Now, even though they talk about hard treatment, there are actually very successful instances of criminal law deterrence that have absolutely nothing to do with prisons or disgusting conditions and so on. If you think about sexual harassment, which is probably the most successful instance I can think of legal deterrence for a very serious offense, of course, no one has gone to prison for that. What happens is the person might lose their job, and that's a very big deterrent for the people that are concerned. Another thing that often happens is the company that doesn't eradicate these bad practices has to pay a lot of money. So there are all these other, we could call them punishments, that are not really grotesque forms of disgusting prison. Yeah. And we should consider exactly what we really want to use. And people somehow think that without really loathsome conditions, we don't deter people. Just looking at the case of sexual harassment, I think that's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. By now, people who are rational have been deterred. And so the few remaining offenders are people with some kind of psychopathic tendency, but in any case, the penalties that we use, such as termination of employment and fines, have been fine. So we should think, what do we really want to do? Now, I guess I'm certainly in favor of trying out alternative treatments. There are lots of cases where treatment reform would be more successful anyway than prison, and I think juvenile justice on the whole is like that. I don't think there should be drug laws at all, but given that we have them, I think we now realize that people who use drugs need treatment. They don't just need to be thrown in jail. I think it's a terrible irony of American racism that so long as the drug problem seemed to be predominantly a black problem, we thought, but a lot of people thought, throw them in jail, lock them up, take away the key. Now that we see that the opiate addiction problem is predominantly white, all of a sudden people said, oh, well, we don't want prison, we want treatment. Yeah. So, you know, that would have been right years ago, but it's so sad that it's only when it's so-called our people that we actually think sensibly.
And actually, the laws that are responsible for so many African Americans being in prison because of drugs were specifically crafted during the Nixon administration. They've been followed through on ever since to do just that, to get a large group that was regarded as a political enemy out of circulation. And then, of course, the marijuana laws did the same thing with the left, with us hippies. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think by now it's being realized that mass incarceration is a terrible failure. Yeah. It's expensive. It's and as the prison population ages, it's getting more and more expensive because all those health bills have to be paid. So I think we're really abandoning that, and it's one issue that has a bipartisan consensus. But we still need to think much more about the ex-ante perspective because it's hard. And we've tried so many things. We've tried housing projects, mixed-income housing, public housing of a wide range of sorts, and educational interventions like pre-K, which I'm a big supporter of, and I think that's, if it's a program that's intelligently designed and of the right sort, that has a real effect on recidivism.
Yes.
So, you know, we just have to coordinate our efforts and work on a number of different fronts and try to solve this problem.
The other concept that you analyze in the book besides that of anger is the concept of forgiveness. So can you talk to us about forgiveness as a response to anger?
The first thing to say is there are actually several different kinds of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So if we just think of the biblical texts, both Jewish and Christian, and I do spend some time on that, there's first of all, and I think it's probably what many people call the canonical form, there's a kind of transactional forgiveness. That mm-hmm. is to say, the person who's wronged is encouraged to demand a certain kind of behavior. You confess, you lower yourself, you promise not to do it again, and it all involves considerable abasement. But that was imported from the relationship between human and God. Mm-hmm. So if one thinks, I mean, my religious views are a little bit different from that, but if one thinks that abasement is the right stance of humans towards God, that makes sense in that relationship. But in the relationship between human and human, mm-hmm. I think we can all agree, whatever our religious views are, that it doesn't have any place. And so in the Gospels, you find that form, but you also find something that interests me a lot more, and mm-hmm. I think it is what Christian teaching, for example, in that South Carolina church where Dylan Roof murdered so many people, mm-hmm. what they had learned was unconditional forgiveness.
Yes,
so
yes,
without
yes.
expecting Dylan Roof to come before them and abase himself, they already wanted to extend forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So to me, and Jesus says this on a number of occasions, that's a lot better, but it has the defect that you are angry first, when I think it would have been better not to be angry in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it also has a sense of, sometimes, of a kind of unpleasant moral superiority. St. Paul even says at one point, forgive them, for by so doing you will heap coals of fire on their head. So that I don't like, because I think it's like a concealed form of anger.
Yeah, passive aggressiveness.
It's
right. a type of shaming.
So what I like is what the father of the prodigal son does, and that is
yes.
he goes out, and before he even knows whether the son is going to apologize or not, he expresses love. Mm-hmm. He just runs to him and hugs him. Now, of course, after that, he will give him advice, and he will probably tell him, you messed up your life, and so on. But, you know, this basis of generosity and unconditional love, and that isn't wishy-washy, I think, at all. It was the attitude that King thought we should have toward everyone, even if they were our opponents. Mm-hmm. We should unconditionally endorse their being and then criticize their bad actions. King said the most important thing was the distinction between the doer and the deed, and that I think we can always do. Mm-hmm. So if you're generous, that isn't weak. It's actually very, very strong. Nelson Mandela was a genius of generous love and inclusion. Mm-hmm. People who thought, he's going to hate us. I heard once a young person who had been a young police recruit when Mandela was inaugurated, and he said when that presidential car went by, I mean, he was a white Afrikaner, he thought, oh, this man is going to hate us because we've behaved really so badly. And instead, Mandela got down from the car, went over to this group of young police recruits and said, our trust is in you. And this man was crying when he said this, because this was at Mandela's funeral, but he was speaking on TV. That generosity wins cooperation in a way that the kind of punitive, resentful attitude is just not going to do. So that's what I'm in favor of. And I'm in favor of it in personal relations, but also in political relations.
Given the injustice in our criminal justice system, especially the racism built into it, we have a society that's supposed to be founded on a notion of liberty and justice for all, and it patently isn't true. It's an ideal we espouse sometimes, but we don't seem to want to put it in practice. So the question, I suppose, is do you have any hope for the future? And I'm asking you as a philosopher, do you, as a philosopher, feel that philosophy can influence the way we conduct our legal and political system toward the good?
Well, I do have a lot of hope. Yeah. And I think when you study the history of South Africa, I mean, it's not in a good state right now, not totally, but good heavens, look where it came from. And Mandela had an amazing power to go beyond the resentful passions The same is true of India. I have great worries about the current government in India because the group that's now in power is the retributive group out of which the assassin of Gandhi came and said that Gandhi's non-anger was not a manly emotion and so on. But in any case, up till now, India has been a thriving democracy precisely because it followed the spirit of Gandhi. Now, in the U.S., I think we have many, many reasons for hope. At the local level, I think, for one thing, the churches have done amazing work. Mm-hmm. You can see those people who responded to the South Carolina shootings with such nobility and such non-anger. It was quite amazing. This one woman who says, I am angry, but I know that I'm a work in progress. Yeah. That whole conception of the self as a work in progress, I mean, she got that from the church, and I think churches all over the country are doing that. I hope my Jewish temple is also doing it, and, you know, we don't quite, Reform Jews are a little bit intellectual, and we don't engage in emotive bonding in quite the same way, and maybe we should do more on that. But anyway, I think we talk about that stuff a lot. So I think that's one place where religion has a big role to play in American society, because America is a very religious country. I think philosophers can certainly help if they can possibly get a hearing, but, you know, this is the country in the world, because of the centrality of religion, where it's particularly difficult for philosophers to play a central role. I mean, I go all over the world, and I talk to politicians in India, Australia, all over Europe, and I address actual politicians. And I mean, I was just in Colombia and addressed, I had a public forum on reconciliation with the governor of the province of Antioquia, to which 500 people came, and I've written a public statement about the new agreement to resolve the drug crisis. So, you know, in that kind of country, they really care what philosophers say. I think it's partly because it's a Catholic country, and the Catholic Church has always been much more philosophical than Protestant churches. In all Catholic universities, you have to take 2 semesters of philosophy at least, and that whole religious tradition is entirely friendly to philosophy in a way that evangelical religion is not, and some other forms of Protestantism. Anyway, whatever the story is, I think that the U.S. is resistant to this, and I guess my own problem is not because of these views, but because of my economic views. I'm placed in a position, namely the European-style social democrat, that's kind of off the left end of the American political spectrum, so people will have some suspicion of me, and I think they are surprised when I seem to be interested in engaging with people who are conservative, but, you know, I really am. I mean, I teach with a very conservative colleague who's a well-known sort of Republican blogger, and I do that deliberately in order to try to understand where he's coming from and to understand, to generate a kind of dialogue in our law students, because they're going to go out and they're going to be social leaders. So we had this seminar on public morality and legal conservatism in which this colleague and I had, you know, big differences, but the students actually had even bigger differences, because my colleague is more a libertarian than a conservative, and the students included some real conservatives. And I loved those students. I thought it was so fantastic that we could really debate these issues in a civil way. But I'm afraid that when somebody in Washington would think, oh, shall we put her on some committee or something, they would think, oh, that left-wing person, that would tarnish our image. And I do actually believe that the president, who used to be a colleague of mine and whom I therefore know, I'm sure he would think that, because he has been accused by the Republicans of harboring left-wing friends, and so he's pretty much dropped such friends. I'm not like Bill Ayers, I'm not anywhere near as far to the left, but in any case, I certainly don't have any contact with the Obama administration.
Interesting that you hit on the two people that our own Eileen Leonard here in the sociology department brought up when I asked her the same question about whether she had any hope for the future, Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela.
And Gandhi, of course.
And Gandhi, of course.
I mean, amazing in that situation, because, I mean, the other two were, well, King was a reformer within a basically decent constitution. Mandela had to get a completely different constitution, but it was basically the same people. But Gandhi had to get a whole bunch of very powerful people to actually leave so that India could govern itself. So in a way, that was the most difficult task of all. And to think that he did it with this image of non-anger and non-resentment, that's pretty amazing.
Well, anyway, it's wonderful you are able to get your ideas out into public discourse.
Well, you know, I don't use social media. And I think if I wanted people to listen to me more, I probably would have to use Twitter and Facebook. I don't do it because I guess I just feel I don't know how to use those media, and I think my own medium is the book, really, and the article, but I love being on the radio. I love being on TV. So those are the things, because I'm a former professional actress, kind of know how to do that.
Yes.
But I think Twitter and Facebook, I don't know how to do.
Well, what you have to say makes its way into those media, in any case, from your books and your interviews. So can you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I'm very delighted to, because we're just trying to wrap up this book. So for a couple of years, I've been working with a colleague of mine who's a legal economist on a book on aging. Now, of course, there are many books on aging, but most of them are about pain and death. Mm-hmm. Ours starts from the observation that the period during which one could be described as aging can sometimes be 30 years, 40 years. If you start at 60 or so, then you could live on for quite some time. And this was well understood in the Roman world. So one of my essays in this book is about Cicero, who, when he was 62, he wrote to his best friend Atticus, who was 65. He says, I'm going to dedicate to you this little work on aging. And he says, you and I are not really into that yet, but we have to look ahead and think what it's like. And so then he writes a dialogue in which the lead character is 83, and that's what he thinks of as actually aged. So anyway, we take our different disciplinary perspectives, and we have fun arguing with each other, and we have essays on friendship in aging, on altruism in aging, love and sex in aging, on the whole question of compulsory retirement. What should we think about it? Should that be reintroduced as people are living longer and longer and it's hard to make pensions last? That's all favors something like that, but I don't. And so we, you know, we just have many arguments about the things that are fun. Is there any use in trying to look backwards at your life, given that we can't change our lives? What value could there possibly be in backward-looking emotions such as pride, guilt, regret? And so they're genuinely philosophical questions, but they're also, it's with a light touch. We think of it as a book for a general audience, and we also think that it gets a lot of fun out of the fact that there are two of us, because one of the things we say is that aging doesn't go well if you don't have friends to argue with. So it practices what we preach. And so we're finishing this. We hope it will pretty soon be turned into the publisher. We're just making some cuts and revisions and so on, and we have a contract with Oxford, so it'll come out in probably about a year.
Wonderful. And there's a growing audience out there that's going to be very
well, you know, we want to say is, look, it's not just the ones who are 60 and above, but if you think about Cicero's little dialogue, the 83-year-old is talking to two guys who are about 30, and they come to him because they say, well, you know, if we're lucky enough to live that long, we have to kind of look ahead and think what that time of life is like. And since you seem to be doing pretty well, won't you tell us? And so we kind of hope that that will be a big part of the audience for that book. And of course, people have parents and relatives also who are aging.
So I'd like to thank you, Martha, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice, published by Oxford this April.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it very much, Tom. It's always fun to talk to an audience, which I hope is out there. And let me just say that if anyone who hears this wants to email me reactions or questions, I'd be very glad. My email is on the website of University of Chicago.
Wonderful. Thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with the renowned moral, political, and legal philosopher Martha Nussbaum today on the Library Cafe. If you tuned in late, you can find a podcast of this interview at library-cafe.org. We'll be back after this public service announcement from the American Philosophical Association.
Some thoughts from John Cleese.
I am here today to talk about philosophy. Wait, before you tune out thinking bunch of eggheads talking about ideas that have no bearing on the real world, remember, it was philosophy that inspired men like Martin Luther King and Booker T. Washington to fight against racial prejudice. Philosophy formed the basis of Jane Addams' efforts to make a better life for the poor at Hull House. And it was philosophy that fired up Simone de Beauvoir to demand equality for women. Philosophy is the starting point for making society more just.
A message from the Philosophers of America, celebrating 100 years of thought.